So this is a story from Jack Kornfield's book, The Wise Heart. In a large temple north of Thailand's ancient capital, Sukhothai, was an enormous clay Buddha, 500 years old. Not so beautiful, but revered for longevity. Imagine what happened in 500 years. It started to crack. After long, dry, hot spell, a crack really big opened up, and the monks look inside. I'm actually paraphrasing here, with a flashlight and see brilliant gold. And so they kind of realize that there's something really, really valuable under this already very revered ancient clay statue. So they break it open and reveal inside one of the largest, most luminous golden Buddha statues in Southeast Asia. And it's now a huge pilgrimage site. And people think that it was basically protected due to war and conflict. And they didn't want someone to find this massive gold Buddha. And then people forgot about it somehow. I'm not sure how, but a gold Buddha like that, so valuable, so sacred to Thai culture, just was forgotten about. But Jack says, well, but maybe some very wise person knew that impermanence would reveal the golden Buddha, that maybe people had so much foresight that they knew that their clay Buddha over time would crack and reveal the golden Buddha, and it would be protected in the meantime. So this impermanence would reveal the true nature of the clay Buddha, which is the golden Buddha. Very wise. This is sort of a parable for impermanence, and that impermanence can kind of crack open the clay us and reveal the golden us, the wise us, the us that a lot of you have talked about in our discussions today, that the us that can sort of roll with the ups and downs of life without doing our own added ups and downs, that we can just take the ups and take the downs without so much extra stress. And actually, it's been quite a theme today, that a lot of you are feeling that from your practice in your life. Joseph Goldstein, one of my Vipassana teachers, one of the founders of this lineage of Theravada Buddhism in the U.S., he says that Vipassana practice is wisdom practice. The more you practice, the wiser you get, just by definition. Life makes us wise, I mean, over time. Some of you really talked about that too, how much, though your bodies don't feel as good, your mind feels much wiser. And like, that's a pretty good trade-off, I would guess. So life wisens us up, and practice accelerates the process. You could say practice is kind of like accelerated living. The more we are just aware of our experience, the more we learn from it. The wiser we get, the more we try to affect that which we can affect, and the more we let go of trying to change what's impossible to change. We get more at peace with what's in our control and what isn't, and we realize a lot is out of our control. And actually, rather than that being bad news, it's actually good news. We align with it and we let go. And as a friend of mine likes to say, the less I practice, the more in control I think I am. The more we practice, the wiser we get. And we realize a lot is out of our control. And I'm not talking about outside of this room. I'm not talking about outside of your body. We're working with our body, and hopefully this is one of the lessons that we're starting to see from this, and I'll talk about that a little more. So as we get wiser and we understand how things are, we stop blaming ourselves for that which we can't control. We don't blame ourselves for our suffering as if we order up our suffering when something difficult happens, you know? We're sitting there in the line in the bank, and we've got an appointment at 2:30, and we see this long line, but we have to make this deposit, and we don't know if we're going to get to the bank, you know, the appointment in time, and we start to feel our stress meter go up. But then we stop and we say, no, oh, right, so I'm in a bank. I might not make my appointment on time. What's the right emotion? Is it love? Is it calm? Is it fear? Is it jealousy? You know, is it impatience? Oh, impatience, right. Oh, I'm going to get impatient, right? Is that what we do? Of course not. We don't order it up. We just get impatient. You know, we don't consciously choose that difficult reaction. It just happens. And we stop blaming ourselves for our troublesome states when they arise, because we really get this insight the more we practice. We're not ordering it up. We don't order up our misery. It comes. We can respond. We can wake up to it and make a choice. But it's usually after the fact that we wake up. That's when we can do something. But when you wake up to a difficult state, it was out of your hands until you woke up to it. What determined that, made that difficult state of impatience arise from you, the bank, was just my habits. So we stop adding extra suffering, not just when something falls apart in our life, but when we get into our own kind of difficult state that we add to it. We don't even blame ourselves for that. We don't, you know, so there's a difficulty. We make it double difficult by kind of, you know, reacting against it. But then we make it triple difficult by blaming ourselves for having such an impatient reaction. And so we start to stop doing that. We start to stop doing that. We don't add the triple. And maybe eventually we won't add the double difficulty, and we'll just accept difficulty as difficulty. And there's something so simple and helpful when we can do that. Rather than struggling against it, we just accept. And we do what we can do. And then when there's nothing left to do, we accept that. It's very simple. So this is what our practice does. It makes us wiser. And the main way we're doing that on this retreat, so far today, we've opened to sound. Mostly we've been working with the body. We've opened to sound a little bit. The same lessons we learn in the body apply to everything. So they're applying to sound as well. But I'm going to really talk mostly about sound. So if I was to title the talk, it would be called Body as River. Or Body as Waterfall. Because that's hopefully what we're getting a little taste of, or maybe a big taste of. So, have you noticed change occurring in your body? Remember, the concept body is static, but when the experience of body, have you noticed change? Yes? No? Have you noticed a lot of change? Some of you say yes, some of you say no. How many would say, I've noticed a lot of change in my body, in my sensations? Let's just... So the rest of you are somewhere below a lot. Yeah. Some change. When awareness gets strong, what you start seeing is this body is just a massive flux of sensation. It's like a snap, crackle, pop display. A buzz here, a pulse there, a little tiny itch there. Oh, then a little more, you know, constant, say, throb in the elbow. You know, a little itch on the foot. And, you know, it's just going all over the place. It's kind of like maybe a subtle firework display, but a firework display of sensation. So this is the experiential level. I'll talk about that more. But it's really interesting that that experiential level is really being affirmed by science now that science is sophisticated enough to really know what the processes are happening in the body. So the body is made up of 50 to trillion cells. Over 50,000 of these cells will die and be replaced with new cells while you're listening to this sentence. The body makes new stomach lining every 3 days, a new liver every 6 weeks, replaces our hair 2 to 5 years, our eyebrows every 3 to 5 months. We get new skin once a month and a new skeleton every 7 years. If you are your body, it means you're in constant flux. Which body are you? The one that just lost 50,000 cells a second ago, or this one now with the new 50,000 cells? Which is you? It's massive flux. So we science knows this. It's more important for us to know it experientially. When we see our body as river, it's not like the body disappears. Letting go isn't about some magic trick. Letting go is actually just about seeing things for what they are. So when we see our body as river instead of just body as this like fixed static thing that doesn't change, but we see it as this constant flow, then we relate to it more like a river. A river's really interesting. It's moving, it's fluid, it floods, it dries up, it fills with leaves in the fall, it freezes in the winter, it's exciting, uncontrollable, unpredictable. You might swim in it, kayak in it, take advantage of all that turbulence, make that all that turbulence some kind of excitement. But what you wouldn't try and do is grab it and hold on to it, you know. If it was a waterfall, you wouldn't try to lean up against it. You might take pretty pictures, you might see a little rainbow mist coming off the waterfall on the right angle, but you're not going to like lean against it. It's not reliable. It would be ludicrous to lean against it. You just fall over and be soaking wet. It's ludicrous to think that our bodies are going to just be bodies. The law of our bodies are they fall apart. The law of our bodies is they don't just fall apart. Our bodies grow and, you know, become amazing. And then we fall apart. And maybe we can see the falling apart as amazing, as a kind of grace. You know, this is all on the macro scale, but on the micro scale is what we're focused on. Really seeing that, oh, I know what Peter's talking about. Yeah, my body's just this flow. It's this constant flow, this snap, crackle, pop. That's my body. My body is not this static idea. So I somehow have a river in me because last month I led a 10-day Vipassana canoe trip on the Colorado River, which a year ago, Marvin and Paula came on when we lit it a year ago. So I'm just off the river, and there's something about a river that just is so moving, pun intended, I guess. It just works on you when you sleep by it night after night. And so this is not to say that when we relate to our bodies as river, that somehow we're going to lose anything. I think what we do is we gain a sense of appreciation for our bodies as nature. Our bodies is like, you know, this amazing thing that we just were born with, born as. So I had the river just running through me so much that I had to keep being near the river. So Lisa and I, any chance we got outdoors, I'm like, hon, I just want to go sit by the river. Can we just go meditate by the river? She'd stay with me a little bit and eventually, you know, wander off. And I just wanted to be next to the river. And so I couldn't get enough of that outdoors. So indoors, and then I would have to do things like watch movies like A River Runs Through It. how many of you have seen the movie? How many of you have not seen the movie? A couple. Mostly the younger crowd. It's an older movie, 20 years old. It is such a beautiful movie. It's about relationship. It's about love. It's about tragedy. It's about a complete lifespan. The narrator tells pretty much his whole life story in the movie. And it's also about rivers and fly fishing. And the narrator says, my father was a Presbyterian minister and a fly fisherman. This is in Montana in the 1920s. In our family, there was no clear line between religion and fly fishing. So the movie develops, and I'm going to totally ruin the movie for those of you who haven't seen it, so my apologies to those few of you. And it's really a character development. It's the narrator is a brother, older brother. His younger brother is Brad Pitt, when Brad Pitt was like, you know, whenever, early 20s. You know, really super handsome, still super handsome, right? But, you know, really young Brad Pitt. And the older brother's bookish. The younger brother's just kind of freewheeling, you know, happy-go-lucky, probably terror of a kid, troublemaker. But the father and the two boys just love fishing, and their whole life they have this bond over fishing. And it develops their character, and the older brother, you know, goes away to college and leaves Montana, eventually comes back, and Brad Pitt's character is a newspaper man. It's, you know, the frontier days, it's wild and woolly, and he's does a lot of gambling. And he's getting into a lot of trouble with his gambling. And so they have one night where the older brother, they're probably in their late 20s, the older brother accompanies Brad Pitt's character, forget the name, Paul, I think, to this, you know, saloon. And there's a backroom, you know, high-stakes poker game, and Brad Pitt tries to go in and join it, and he pretty much almost gets beaten up. They're so mad at him. So clearly he's a lot in debt. And his older brother says, let's get out of here. We're going, you know. And Brad Pitt's like, no way. Tonight's my lucky night, you know. So I'm going to win. And so the older brother's like, you shouldn't stay here. You shouldn't stay here. And Brad Pitt's like, nope, it's my lucky night, Paul. And so the older brother starts to drive away. And Brad Pitt runs up and like, okay, I'm staying, but we're going fishing tomorrow, 6:30, you, me, and Dad, just like the old times. And so the older brother's like, fine. And so the next morning, 6:30 rolls around. Paul hasn't shown up yet. 7 o'clock rolls around, Paul hasn't shown up, and it's Dad and the older brother waiting. Dad doesn't know anything about this, but the older brother is really nervous. And then 7:05, boom, the door opens, Brad Pitt comes in. You meanwhile think Brad Pitt has been offed, you know, but he wasn't. He's like, let's go fishing, you know, and he had a great night. And there's this amazing scene on the river that day where Brad Pitt is fly fishing. The father and the brother are up a slope just hanging out. The dad is a Presbyterian minister. He's like reading poetry. He kind of didn't want to fish too much that day. But dad and older brother are hanging out, and they see Paul down in the river, and he suddenly snags this huge fish because his rod is like doubled over, and he starts getting carried downstream. And the movie's so great because you just see Brad Pitt's character eventually go all the way underwater as he's kind of getting, you know, walked downstream, but he's still holding up the rod, and his hat floats away, but he's holding up the rod, keeping the tension on the line, and then he lands this gigantic fish, gigantic trout. And so I'll just narrate a little bit from the movie. So his older brother, I mean, there's Brad Pitt just holding this fish, just grinning, you know, so big. And the father and brother are just amazed. And so they run down to him. And the brother says, the narrator, "At that moment, I knew surely and clearly that I was witnessing perfection. My brother stood there before us, not on a bank of the big Blackfoot River, but suspended above the earth, free from all its laws, like a work of art. And I knew just as surely and just as clearly that life is not a work of art, and that moment could not last." So, peak moment. And the movie sort of built up to this whole thing. And then it all falls apart very fast. The next scene is actually a scene where the narrator is telling you that Paul did indeed die later, like a few days later, in a gambling fight. And you just can't believe it, and you're heartbroken. So, so the movie, it doesn't spend a lot of time there, but the narrator is showing different scenes. It's showing the mother and father just bereaved, you know, alone, eating breakfast together. And the narrator says, "And as time passed, my father struggled for more to hold on to, asking me again and again if I had told him everything about Paul. And finally I said to him, 'Maybe all I really know about Paul is that he was a fine fisherman.'" And there's a pause. And then the father says, "You know more than that. He was beautiful." Father speaking of his brother. And the narrator says, "And that was the last time we ever spoke of my brother's death. Indirectly, though, Paul was always present in my father's thoughts. I remember the last sermon I heard him give not long before his own death." So then you see a church scene and dad's giving a sermon. "Each one of us here today will at one time in our lives look upon a loved one who is in need and ask the same question. 'We are willing to help, Lord, but what, if anything, is needed? For it is true that we can seldom help those closest to us. Either we don't know what part of ourselves to give, or more often than not, the part we have to give is not wanted. And so it is those we live with and should know who elude us. But we can still love them. We can love them completely without complete understanding." So that's that scene. We can love. He's talking about Paul. We can love completely without complete understanding. And then you see the narrator, Norman is his name, as an old man in the middle of a river, tying a fly with old kind of clumsy fingers, and then casting in the river. And at times it's zoomed in on him, at times it's backed out, and you're seeing this old man alone fly fishing in a river in this just gorgeous landscape. And the narrator says, "Now nearly all those I loved and did not understand in my youth are dead, even Jesse," that's his wife, so he's really old now, "but I still reach out to them. Of course, now I am too old to be much of a fisherman, and now I usually fish the big waters alone, although some friends think I shouldn't. But when I am alone in the half light of the canyon, All existence seems to fade to a being with my soul and memories and sounds of the Big Blackfoot River and a four count rhythm and the hope that a fish will rise. And then you just see this old guy casting, this four count cast. And then the narrator says, eventually all things merge into one, and a river runs through it. And then it cuts to a scene of water running over rocks in the river. The river was cut by the world's great flood and runs over rocks from the basement of time. On some of the rocks are timeless raindrops. Under the rocks are the words, and some of the words are theirs. Long pause. Back to this old man, just knee-deep in a river, in this beautiful landscape, casting. Last line of the movie, I am haunted by waters. Long pause. Credits. Seeing this movie makes me think of my own dad, my mom, and just the immense layers of experience that we all have and we're all holding. And there's something about this man being in the river that just profoundly moved me. And we can really get it that the river is just not out there. It's us. It's who we are. Nature is us. And when we just keep showing up for our experience in this very ordinary way that we're doing, we start to taste these waters and maybe even be haunted by them. One of the things that can start to haunt you about your body and your body as river is to really get this experience that, oh, wow, this body is doing snap, crackle, pop all by itself. I'm not doing that. Are you sitting there and ordering up a throb in your elbow, a little itch on top of your head, maybe your leg is hurting a little bit from your sit. Are you ordering that up? It just happens. And you start to see, wow, this body really is nature, and it really is a river. It is just flow. And, you get this great sense of, I belong, when you start experiencing yourself this way. I'm not this separate, static, independent thing. I am this flow of nature. And that's I have kinship with everything I see around me. The birds, the trees, the river, the wind. I am that. The idea that if there's just this body and it's me is so limiting and so static. So we can get it. There's a big relief that our body is not limited to this little me. The body has a mind of its own. The body is doing its dance all by itself. And it's our ideas that blind us to it. But when we practice, we see it. We are the river. A river runs through it, and all is one. So this is part of the insights we get. We could start to see the body as flow. We start to see that the flow is not in our control. We don't order it up. So how can we blame ourselves for it? We have some control. We can get up and move, if the pain is too unbearable. But the body has its own agenda. just think of you and your body. All you did was mature, you know, starting from age zero. You just matured, developed, infant, toddler, elementary kid, teenager, young adult, adult. Body just, all it did was change. Did you decide how tall you were going to grow to be? Did you decide what hair color you were, you know, you came out with? did you decide at what age your hair was going to start graying a little bit, if it has? Did you decide how you know, natural an athlete you were going to be? It's just the body. The body is its own thing. And to get this is to get happy. We actually get happy when we have this sense of I belong, I'm nature, I'm not just some separate static thing. So the insights we get are around change, around the change is not in our control. Therefore, we can take our body less personally. That's very freeing. I want to just guide us a wee little bit in another insight that we can get by being aware of our body. So if you would, just come into awareness of one of your hands. This will be short. And just really see if you can be aware of the sensations in the top of the palm. Whatever's there, just notice. See if you can then be aware of sensations in the fingers, pinky, ring finger, middle, index, thumb. And now see if you can just kind of take in the whole hand, palm, fingers. Now notice, are you creating a mental image of hand? Just notice if that's there. Go back to feeling the sensations. See if it's possible to feel sensations without the image. The image is simply a mental creation. It's not actually sensory experience. See if you can just feel the sensations. And if you do image, then just notice the image, but return to attention to sensation. Okay. See, actually, one more thing. See if you can notice the boundary of the top of the palm with space. Notice where there's sensation and where there's not. Then maybe notice the boundary on the edge of your hand, pinky, down palm. Notice where there's sensations of pinky and edge of hand, and then notice where there's just space and no sensation. So this could be a trippy thing to realize that you cannot experience body as a sensation. Body is a concept, just like your imaging hand. That's an image, that's a mental construct. What you experience is sensation in a location, and maybe the sensation has shape. But the tactile felt sense doesn't experience hand. It's pulse, tingle, throb in a location, in a shape. And what's around that shape is lack of sensation. So through this tactile sense, what we experience are sensations and lack of sensations. Or as Joseph Goldstein likes to say, sensations in space. We don't experience sensations in a body. What we actually experience is just sensations in space, located in space. That's kind of trippy. It's very ordinary. It's not like, you know, taking mushrooms or something. This is very ordinary. This is our ordinary experience. This is what starts to happen when we get aware of our body. It's just a field of sensation. And it's only through ideas that we add the image hand, we add the idea hand, and then we say my hand. That's all on the concept level. On the bare sensation level, there's just sensations in space. So don't stretch too far for this, because if it doesn't make sense to you now, keep practicing and it will. And you start to really lose identification with your body as me and mine. And when you do that, it feels better. It's nature. That's what it is. That's what I am. I'm nature. So there's one other thing that I think will be nice to just highlight. There's a change in our body that we can't experience. And that change is aging. You can't experience being old. What you experience, you might experience being tired. You might experience an ache or a pain, but that's not a sensation of old. Sensation is pulse, throb, ache, you know, whatever tired feels like. So that's just a concept. I'm getting old. Now, we can look in the mirror and we can see our hair is gray. So, you know, we can experience that. But the body is a kind of refuge from all our negative ideas about ourselves. I mean, our culture, we're so hard on aging. And it's really cool to know that those are all ideas that on the physical experience, that's not our experience. We don't experience our gender, by the way, you know. You don't have a sensation that says woman or a sensation that says man. So all of our cultural ideas about who we are, this isn't like we just throw those out. We have those, but we get what they are. They're just ideas. We can relate to our body in this way, body as river, as sensation. And it's a big relief. It's a really nice way to relate to our bodies. If we have body image issues in any way, just being with sensation shows us the rest of that are just my ideas about me, and they're painful ideas. So this can be a kind of refuge. So these are some of the insights that help us let go as we pay attention to our bodies more and more. especially as we pay attention to the flux of sensation in our bodies. And, you know, it's ordinary. It isn't fireworks. It's, but it's really the main engine for letting go. When we start having all of these insights, we can't hold on. We don't have to let go. Actually, all we have to do is see that the body is a river. And then we're not going to try to grab it or lean on it. We're going to relate to it as a river. And it's glorious to relate to our bodies as rivers. So I'll just end here by quoting Ajahn Chah, who I quoted last night, who's, you know, this very wise, very revered Thai master from the 20th century, and Jack Kornfield's teacher when he was a monk. Ajahn Chah says, anyone can build a house of wood and bricks, but the Buddha taught that that sort of home is not our real home. It's only ours in name. Our real home is inner peace. An external material home may well be pretty, but it is not very peaceful. There's this worry and then that worry, this anxiety and then that. So we say it's not our real home. It's external to us. Sooner or later, we'll have to give it up. It's not a place we can live in permanently because it doesn't truly belong to us. It belongs to the world. Our body is the same. We take it to be a self, to be me or mine, but in fact, it's not really so at all. It's another worldly home. Your body has followed its natural course from birth until now. It's old and sick, and you can't forbid it from doing that. That's the way it is. Wanting it to be any different would be as foolish as wanting a duck to be like a chicken. When you see that that's impossible, that a duck must be a duck, and a chicken must be a chicken, and that the bodies have to get old and die, you will find courage and energy. However much you want the body to go on lasting, it won't do that. And then he quotes that verse that I quoted last night. All conditioned things are impermanent. Their nature is to arise and pass away. To be harmony in harmony with this truth is the deepest happiness. So we have a little time. If people have any questions or comments, please feel free.
I was noticing clouds earlier, and it was also a great metaphor for just the, you know, the body and how it changes, and they were so stunning, and there was, it was also a reminder of how convincing each moment is in the body and the mind, you know, the state is, it feels so real, so forever, and that's, it's interesting, the idea of a river, because it helps one let go into a flow instead of trying to kind of tweak out some, you know, mystical, philosophical reality that's happening. But it was amazing to see the clouds and just felt like really hardly any time passed, and I looked back and it was completely different, and it was clear that many of my sits had been like that. Like there was particular stickiness that just felt or whatever, and then where did it go? You know, why stress about it? Because it's
right. So I'll try to paraphrase just for the mic. The comment is that another metaphor for her experience, besides river, is cloud, and she was watching clouds, you know, being really struck by how amazing they were, and then turning away and then turning back and they're different. And how that's analogous to your experience of, you know, these things arise and they seem so real, but then they change. And so that's, you know, it's amazing when we can start seeing this about all this stuff that we hold so dear and take so personally. that actually the stuff that's tripping us up. Now this is sort of one side of the equation in terms of working with our emotional difficulty. But a teacher talking to me once about my practice, and he said, you know, Peter, you don't really have to change this. You just have to outlast it. I don't even remember what difficult emotion it was, but it was one of them. You know, that just like what you're saying, if we start to get it, that these, even our difficulties arise and pass the way something flows down a river or the way a cloud shifts its shape, we start relating very differently to our experience. Sometimes, yes, we really do have to step in, figure something out, or take action, or, you know, try to, you know, fix things. We have to do that a lot. But in terms of just relating to our experience itself, if we're being really mindful, often there's very little we have to do other than be mindful. And we were, you know, talking about that this morning too. So it's really very liberating when we start to see this.
So a practice question, if I didn't experience a whole lot of change in my body today while I was meditating, then I want to strengthen my awareness, I guess.
Yes.
And so speak to that.
Sure.
If you will.
The comment is, if you're not seeing a lot of impermanence in the body and you want to deepen your practice around that, how do you do that? What I suggest is to really stay with something. Obviously, if you're with the breath, you're going to see that, because the breath is nothing but change. So I'm going to assume that. So you agree with that? Is that your experience? Yeah. It's just, you know, in and out, rise and fall, and maybe stillness between half breaths. So, you know, that's one very obvious place the body's changing. But, you know, you may just spend time in a given area and get subtle about it. So, for instance, you could be in the hands, and you might want to do a little bit of work, like systematic. So stay with the top of the palm for a while, and then feel the underside of the palm, and then feel each finger. And do it in order, you know, go pinky to thumb, and then back, top of the hand, bottom of the hand. And you may not notice very much at all. Your mind's going to, you know, will get distracted. You just bring it back. But if you have kind of a sequence, but linger in each place for a while, you know, just a good, linger there till you really feel like you're really connecting with the sensation there, even if it's very subtle. And then once you've done that, then move to the new area. And just kind of work with that and just see if what your thinking isn't changing. See if you linger there with your awareness for longer, if that comes, you know, to you more. It may not, but that's one way. It's almost like it might be that for whatever reason, your body sensations are very subtle. I don't know. Is that your experience, that they're pretty subtle? Hard to...
Well, at certain points today, it seemed like that to me, but...
Yeah. Yeah, so the reason I'm saying this is if the sensations are subtle, then your awareness needs to get subtle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's why I'm kind of making it really simple, just by working in one area.
I really get the changing body thing, and I can certainly feel that in the majority of times, but every once in a while I get stuck
and it's usually like in my upper back.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, if I try to stay with it, it almost petrifies and doesn't move. And there's no emotion or anything with it. It's just like, and I've always assumed it's because I tend to hunch
mm-hmm.
in a lot of activities. Mm-hmm. But what would you suggest if you're trying to be with a feeling like that and you just feel like you're really stuck?
Okay. So the question is about feeling a kind of stuck sensation in the upper back. And sensation seems to be flowing in the rest of the body, but not there. Is that a pleasant, unpleasant, neutral kind of stuckness? Unpleasant? And is it mild, medium, strong, that unpleasantness? So strong unpleasantness. So essentially, working with strong unpleasantness in the body is the same as working with pain in the body, you know. With pain in the body, it's great to work with when we're interested in working with it, when we're kind of like, huh, wonder how this is going to be, right? That kind of curiosity. And we can take it up as an object. And the thing to do with it is to really get kind of almost clinical about it. Oh, okay, so how far out into the shoulders does the stuckness go? How far down the back? Does it come, you know, forward much, you know, out of the back? Does it come up into the neck? Really know the boundaries. And then really know, are there some areas that are more intense than others? And then also, is any of this changing? Maybe it's not, you know, because you're saying it's stuck. So, but then almost kind of like I was saying, and do that for a while. But then you also want to let go and be in the rest of your body. You don't want to only focus on that. You want to just do that periodically. Just really take it up. And don't try to make it different than it is. Don't feel like, well, this shouldn't be there. Because that's adding a layer of mental suffering. You're saying there's no emotion in it. So it's purely physical from what you're gleaned so far. So there's no need to create mental suffering around it. Like, I need to get rid of this. This has to go away. Now, it's strongly unpleasant, so obviously that's going to be there. But I think I've said enough about how to work with it mindfully. Does a postural shift ever change it?
Occasionally.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not all sits. It's
okay. It's just certain times.
Yeah.
So because it's not chronic, it's not all sits, it's just certain times. Part of being mindful of it, in addition to that sort of clinical attitude I said, is to really relax. Just relax into it. Fully allow it. And that is tricky, because you're kind of feeling like, well, it's stuck, it shouldn't be stuck, you know. It's stuck, it's just what it is. Just, again, we're always trying to be with experience just as it is. Not trying to fix it, change it, move it. The more we can just show up. Now, strong and pleasantness, you know, that's out, you know, that's higher up on the challenge ladder, but that's why I say just turn towards it at times, but really relax when you do it. Just say, okay, here it is. I don't like it, so, but I'm also going to try to explore it. And notice that I don't like it. That's another piece. So relax, do that whole, like, you know, very almost scientific investigation. And then third is to notice that I don't like. How's that showing up? Is that showing up as sensation, or is that purely mental? Because there can sometimes be extra tensing when there's the don't like.
There's probably mental to that.
Yeah.
It makes it worse.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Or you try to relax.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, play with both. You do want to, you know, doesn't help much to shift, but maybe if it helps a little to shift, great. Go ahead and shift. Do that. It's not going to completely relieve it. You're still going to need to work with it. So then do all the mindfulness stuff. Yeah.
Is it ever allowed? I mean, I know I can do whatever I want, but to like do a little affirmation, like, my body is a river, you know, as I'm trying to relax.
Of course, of course, of course.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. You know, I recommend, I mean, this is the thing, is our practice is one through awareness of non-interference, not changing, just knowing it as it is. But anything we can do that's going to support us in being more mindful is a worthy change. So if it's going to help you be more mindful, change it. Don't just sit there and not interfere. Interfere. And so if that helps you, you know, to say that, great. Now, you know, if you're doing it like, you know, every other mind moment, you've got some new little phrase, you're trying to rah, 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 that's not Vipassana, right? It might work for you, but it's just not Vipassana. So, but you know, to do those things, I mean, relax the body as much as you can a couple times when you're sitting. That's a skillful interference. You know, we all have our little Dharma coach things we say to ourselves. Mine is, of course. You know, if I'm struggling, I just say, of course. And I don't like this, of course. I shouldn't be feeling that, of course. I'm a Dharma teacher, what's wrong with me? Of course. Oh, there's a fly on the wall, of course. There's a car passing by, of course. It's a really nice little coachy thing to do to yourself. And we all stumble across our own, so it's good to have those little tricks. Okay, folks, we're at time.